In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Thank you for joining us today here on the iSpy Radio Show, as every week we help you get a little more intelligence on big government. You know, one of the best ways to win a war is to win it before your enemy even realizes they're at war with you. And this is where we're at today. We've been at war, but not a lot of people have realized that. America started because we won a war against a despot. But we've been at war for decades, for almost two centuries, with those who would rob us of our freedoms. Our founding fathers knew this. They gave us founding documents to keep us free, a republic, ma'am, if you can keep it. They knew and understood the natural inclinations of man. The true war was a war between those who wanted freedom and those who wanted to control and rule over others, that the natural inclination of man is to acquire power. But how they use that power is the difference between freedom and enslavement, whether it's to a king or to a system of government. One could use power to ensure freedoms, that even if someone disagreed with those in power, they could do so, to ensure that you had the right and liberty to pursue happiness in whatever form that took, to be successful and, above all, happy as you pursued this gift from our Creator called life, the only life you will have. Or one could use power to ensure fealty and obedience, and those who were refused or were enemies of the state could be and should be disposed of, that you had no rights except those rights allowed by those in charge. Your happiness was secondary or worse, and certainly of no actual concern. Why should your happiness matter if, frankly, your life didn't matter? I told you last week that Marxists, communists, socialists, progressives, the authoritarians, see the world differently, that their philosophy stems from hate and from contempt for their fellow man. This week, as we continue our discussion with Jonathan E. Mord, you'll hear just how loathsome their worldview truly is. Why is this important? Because you need to understand your enemy. You need to understand we really are at war. You need to understand just how far they will go because they are already at war with you. It's time to wake up to this, and it's time to stop acting like we're not at war. And it's time all of us declare war on them. I'd like to welcome back Jonathan E. Mord, who is one of America's top constitutional lawyers, and he joined us last week to discuss his latest book, The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. This week, we're going to more fully dive into that book. Jonathan, welcome back. It's great to talk to you again.
Well, great to be with you again.
You know, I have just been so thoroughly enjoying your book, and I want to focus this week really on the rise of Marxist, socialist, you know, the authoritarian thinking in America, how it started, how it spread, and then give our audience some of your suggestions for how to stop this before it's too late. I know that we're not going to get through all of the things I'd love to talk about, so gosh, people are just going to have to buy your book, and I really can't recommend enough that people do that. Now, you know, I'd like to start, though, with one of the philosophers that is really the key point of all of this. And a lot of people know that Karl Marx and Marxist ideology formed the basis for communism, which incorporated socialism. But fewer people know that the foundations of Marxism came from a German philosopher, Friedrich Hegel, who believed and taught that the state should be all powerful. So talk to us about the basics of his philosophy and how he saw freedom and the role of the state.
So Friedrich Hegel, with the growth of industrialization in Europe, created a new philosophy of collectivism. And what he taught, which fit well with Bismarck's Germany, was this idea that the state was rightfully all-powerful, that individuals' rights, as were expressed by John Locke in the Second Treatise on Government, were bunk, that rights actually didn't come from God, that rights came from the state, and that the state was correctly able to best steer people in a direction that would serve the common good, and that individual rights that stood in the way of the common good were illegitimate because the only appropriate use of power individual power was to serve the state, that is to serve the common good. And for individuals who were opposed to the common good, well, they were just against progress and they were against efficiency and they were enemies of the people and of the state. So this concept of collectivism was very much popular in Bismarck's Germany, and actually Hegel was the teacher of Karl Marx. Karl Marx based his concepts of communism at root on Hegelian philosophy. Not only was Hegelian philosophy popular in Germany, but it was also extraordinarily popular among academics in this country. And they flocked to Germany, to the Hegelian schools in Germany, to learn this collectivism. And they were taught to despise our Constitution, to despise individual rights, and to accept the future as inextricably wed to this notion of the state leading the common good. And they chose, through these schools, to teach about the administrative state. In Germany, they were experimenting with the creation of a government outside of the traditional government, the administrative state, which would rule effectively over the existing government. And the purpose of it was to enable experts, this new idea that there were people who were academically superior to everyone else, who could divine what was in our best interest even if they didn't know who we were. This idea that experts knew all and that solutions came from science, and that we were to be led like sheep by experts, was something that was very much taught to these academics from America, who brought it back and then created the administrative state precisely for the purpose of undermining and overruling the Constitution, the separation of powers, and the fundamental unit of American liberty, individual rights, in order to pursue this this Hegelian collectivist end.
And it was so crazy what they were doing. It was just a complete violation of everything that America stood for. So do you think Hegel or Marx ever stopped to think that if they lived in the society that they promoted, where someone else decided your future, that they themselves might never have been allowed to go into the professions that they chose that allowed them to spew their "you don't need your stinking freedoms" philosophies?
Yes, I think they probably contemplated that, but the fact of the matter was they were arrogant in assuming that they would be on top of the society. You know, the communist is never one who thinks that others will dictate what he or she is to do. They always think they're going to be the ones in charge. Otherwise, they wouldn't advocate communism. The only person who's free in a communist state is the one who's in the leadership position. Everybody else is a slave.
Right.
So, of course, no one would willingly become a slave unless they were deluded. And while communism is a delusion, for those who run it, they understand precisely what's happening. They're taking over your property, your lives, your liberty, and using it all to their own personal advantage. So they expected to rule. They didn't expect to be ruled.
Pretty amazing. Okay, coming up, how exactly did socialism and taking away rights take root right here in America, the land of the free? More with Jonathan E. Moore, constitutional attorney and author of The Authoritarians. And welcome back. We're talking today with Jonathan E. Moore, discussing his book, The Authoritarians. This is an extremely timely book, one that every red-blooded patriot needs to read so that you can better understand the mindset of those currently trying to tear down America and how we fight back. So shifting now into the origins of authoritarianism in America and the antebellum South, before we get into all of that, at the time that Hegel was teaching and philosophizing, the world had already gone through tyranny. I mean, you had previous English monarchs, you had the French monarchs, and on back through history to the Romans, Egyptians, and so forth, where the many were oppressed or even enslaved by the few. But America had risen in Hegel's time, too. How is it that he looked at America's freedom and liberty and arrive at the thought that those societies where the many were enslaved to the few was somehow a better world?
Well, they had this view that the dislocations that were taking place in the revolution, or the assumed dislocations, were all a result of excesses of individual liberty. And that while the Industrial Revolution created this extraordinary middle class that hadn't existed before, a massive middle class, and created upward mobility where people could go from poverty to riches. They didn't see that. What they saw from their elitist vantage point was a change in society that brought in immigrants, that brought in people that they didn't like to associate with based on either their race or their backgrounds, and enabled them to have positions of stature, which upset their concept of the perfection of the races and of this historic dialectic, which they thought would ultimately end in Europeans ruling the planet and people of their social class being the ones in leadership positions. So it was quite unsettling for them to see that capitalism and individual liberty would result in dramatic changes in the society that they could not predict or control. So this is all about control, and it is analogous, very closely analogous, to the absolute monarchy craze of prior centuries, in which an absolute monarch would rule without question over all matters and would be thought to be divinely positioned to do that. They were essentially recreating this whole notion of absolute control based on a theory or a dogma that would replace absolute monarchy.
So as far as Hegelian philosophy taking root in the antebellum South, I'd just like to read this from chapter one. It's from South Carolina Congressman William Porcher Miles, and you say this: Miles held it to be false doctrine, the idea that liberty was a birthright at all. He maintained that liberty was an acquired privilege, not an unalienable right. And those who believed otherwise subscribed to the monstrous and dangerous fallacy of Thomas Jefferson, which proclaimed that all men are created equal. Men are born neither free nor equal, Miles insisted. That is just really stunning. And yet, as you outline in the book, that was pretty much the mindset of the antebellum South, their philosophers, their politicians, even their religious leaders.
The problem for Southerners who owned slaves and for their leadership, the leadership of the government in the South, was that they had to come up with a defense for the institution of slavery because they weren't willing to get rid of it. Economically, it would be to their great disadvantage, and so they chose not to do it. And Northern abolitionists were arguing that it was a moral wrong, that it was evil, the institution of slavery, that slavery itself was an abominable institution that deprived people of their fundamental rights, and that the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence was meant to apply to all mankind, men and women, those who were in bondage and those who are not, were all entitled to unalienable rights. And that indeed was the intention of Thomas Jefferson when he wrote it, as is apparent from a 164-word paragraph that was deleted by two of the Southern states as a condition precedent for their participation in the Revolution. But when he wrote those words, he was writing them cognizant that they would be applicable to those who were in bondage, as well as those who were black and whites and all women and everyone. So the word all men are created equal was actually understood by Jefferson to mean humankind, all people. And so they had to, Jefferson's a Southerner. The Southerners had revered the Constitution, revered the Declaration of Independence, remembered their ancestors who fought in the Revolution. And now they were in a conundrum. What would they do? And so they chose, unfortunately for them, to reject individual liberty, to reject the whole notion of Lockean rights, individual rights, the foundational principles of the Constitution, and to reject Thomas Jefferson, and instead found Friedrich Hegel's philosophy of socialism perfectly matched to the institution of slavery. They could now argue, using Hegel's philosophy, that slavery was a good thing. It was a part of a historical development. Progress, they said, was only possible if blacks served as the mudsill of a foundation that whites would dominate. And so they justified the institution of slavery because they said it was an opportunity for an inferior race to acclimate itself to a superior race, and progress would only be possible because that inferior race would do the things that whites didn't want to do and would enable whites to progress faster. And so they argued that this was good for everyone. And they used Hegel, they used socialism as the justification. In fact, they even referred to it. George Fitzhugh said that the institution of domestic slavery was the beau ideal of communism. And so that was the foundational principle for the Confederacy.
Well, I can certainly see why the socialists of today, so much of the left wants people to think that the Confederates then would be today's Republicans, that there was this political flip that happened because they don't want people to realize socialism was the guiding philosophy of the South to defend slavery and racism. This was the basis of their thoughts, socialist thinking. I was really fascinated by that discussion in your book, this notion that where they saw that this inferior race, blacks, could only advance by latching onto a superior race, meaning the whites. How exactly did Hegel and the Southerners see blacks as advancing through slavery? I mean, what kind of advancement potential did they think being enslaved would lead to?
Well, it starts predicated on racism, and it's the comparable aspects to our current situation are profound. Those Antifa, BLM, they are Hegelians. They are people who actually advanced into the Marxist realm, of course, but fundamentally they're Hegelians, and they believe in slavery. It's just that everyone is enslaved to the state. They also operate on that naive assumption that they individually will be the rulers. Of course, the truth is that they'll end up with one ruler or a very small group, and they'll kill everybody else. That's the history of communism and Marxism. But the notion that Republicans are somehow, that the Republican Party or Republicans are somehow the party of slavery is absurd, because, of course, the Republican Party came out of Abraham Lincoln's efforts to destroy the institution of slavery and to restore those foundational principles of the Declaration of Independence as a unifying national principle, that as it had been since the founding of the Republican in the 1770s. So we end up with this rewrite of history, which is part of a Marxist narrative. Marxists are never content with history as it is. They have to rewrite it to create this dialectic by force. They have to have an oppressor class, an oppressed class, a proletariat and a bourgeoisie. And what they do under our current circumstances is, rather than using wealth disparities as a basis for argument, which doesn't take them too far because of the extent of the middle class in the United States and the extent of the prior administration's success in causing people to lift out of poverty,
yes,
they instead focused on race, because it's an immutable characteristic. So they can say that there is an oppressed race and an oppressor race, and they can use that as a basis to divide people and to induce them to believe in revolution instead of accepting that indeed, as Martin Luther King said, that we ought to be judged by the content of our character rather than the color of our skin.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny that that's the way that they've gravitated to, especially when so much of Marxists and Hegel themselves, I mean, they were massive racists for sure.
Yes.
Okay, more with Jonathan Emord after this. Coming up, one of the most vile and disgusting aspects of the authoritarians and socialists, which also happens to be one of their foundational principles. And welcome back. We're talking today with one of America's top constitutional lawyers, Jonathan Emord. His book, The Authoritarians, is one that you will definitely want to get. It truly explains the rise of socialists and Marxists and how their sick anti-American thinking took hold here in the land of the free and will help you better understand that mindset. And Jonathan, moving forward now a little bit post-Civil War, we had the Industrial Revolution, and this started, of course, in the early 1800s, and then there was the Second Industrial Revolution in the late 1800s. And the Hegelian philosophers, the Marxists, the authoritarians, they began attacking capitalism, of course, because it freed people. As you pointed out in that last segment, and as you point out in your book, even Lincoln said that through free labor, one could raise one's station until you got your own land or shop and then hire others. And so this was really a means of freeing yourself. And of course, when you want big government to control everything, this is an anathema to you. I found it interesting that the progressives in that period reacted to poor labor conditions. Basically, they were upset when factory owners treated their workers like slaves, which is what they had just been defending.
Well, they had to have an excuse for, really, in the end, it's all about self-interest. So you have the leaders of the progressive movement were largely Protestants who were from the upper middle class or from the upper class, and we're witnessing dramatic changes in the environment, economic environment, social environment, due to a massive increase in immigration and also the rise of this middle class, and also the appearance of individuals who came from foreign countries in the upper class. So you have people like Joseph Kennedy, for example, who, selling bootleg whiskey, ended up becoming fabulously wealthy and then being very politically influential through the use, strategic use of his wealth and alliances. And this upset the old guard. So the old guard, their children, expressed their angst over these social changes by advocating social movements and political changes that would ensure a caste, basically that would correct the market's changes in their view, and keep them in place as the leaders and enable them to determine the direction of society rather than be victimized by society's changes. This is really at the root of progressivism and explains a lot why people could do such awful things to other people and could discriminate against people with the use of the law so profoundly during this period. It's not remarkable in this respect. It is a very commonplace, even a socialist Hofstadter who wrote much about this period and was a progressive himself, said that this racism and this elitism that I just mentioned really drove things in that era and led people to do things that were outwardly said to be for the benefit of society, but actually in practice were designed to keep certain segments of the population down so that they could continue to rule or would otherwise alienate certain people from benefits or opportunities in the marketplace so that they could, again, maintain control.
And it was interesting, too, your discussion there about how their idea of controlling things and controlling capitalism actually led to monopolies, which, you know, of course, was disastrous for the market. Speaking of doing awful things to each other, I found your discussion of eugenics and the progressive slash socialist wholehearted embrace of it to be truly fascinating, because to me, the eugenics movement really underpins and is the defining foundation of all their beliefs that no one person has individual rights up to and including the right to life or even the right to procreate. I mean, the purpose of life is to continue life. But here in their mindset, the state will decide. And they saw this as the actual justification and high calling of their movement. The state decides these things. So talk to us especially about Buck versus Bell and the twisted reasoning on that.
So Buck versus Bell is sort of the high watermark or the critical point at which the notion of eugenics becomes a part of American law fundamentally. Eugenics, that is the use of state power to selectively determine who may procreate and who may not, to categorize those who may not as unfit, to define people's characteristics as ones that are inheritable, despite the contrary science. Even at that time, there was no science of any legitimacy that could support this idea of a master race. And yet what they did with eugenics from the period of 1907 all the way into the 1980s, believe it or not, was to have institutions in the state that individuals could be assigned to by a court and then be forcibly sterilized. Over 60,000 Americans were forcibly sterilized and deemed unfit. Now, unfit, that category was broad, and it included people who committed crimes, people who were on the wrong side of the tracks, who were generations in poverty, people who were physically handicapped, people who had mental defects of one kind or another, or people who had poor morals. And in the case of Carrie Buck, the situation was this. She was, as a young girl, she was raped by her nephew, who was the son of her caretakers, these parents, two individuals who kept her as their child because her own parents had suffered death, and they were then in she was in their custody, but their son physically abused her. Well, they were embarrassed by this, and they didn't want to admit to it. So they then tried to ostracize her and essentially blame her for loose morals, alleging that she was impregnated by others. And so they then had her put away in one of these institutions, and she became a sham case illustrative of eugenics. What happened to her was that she, unbeknownst to her, she was assigned an attorney who was actually in cahoots with the prosecution.
Yes. Yeah, that was fascinating.
And then he didn't put up any adequate defense, and very weak evidence was placed in favor of this idea that she had a hereditary defect that made her an imbecile. She wasn't at all. And then they authorized her sterilization, the sterilization of her daughter, and then also the sterilization of her mother. This case went up to the Supreme Court, and in a very terse and cruel decision, Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a eugenicist, he, along with many, many, many others who led the progressive movement in this country, were also eugenicists. And he believed that she presented a perfect example or opportunity for him to ensconce in the law protection for eugenics in the state. So he held under the 14th Amendment that she didn't have a right to liberty against the state's demand to end imbecility by proceeding on this false doctrine that one person who was an imbecile would beget imbeciles. So he then authorized her to have her fallopian tubes cut forcibly by the state against her will. And that then happened, and she was denied children. So one thing I might add, Oliver Wendell Holmes, to show you just how extraordinarily gruesome and brutal his philosophy was, he had said in private correspondence that he thought that we ought to routinely test children after they're born to see their relative intelligence. And those that didn't make the grade, he was in favor of infanticide, killing them, in order to protect the gene pool, to ensure that the nation would advance to a higher level of intellectual ability by exterminating those.
Yes, and that really just shows the horrific nature of this kind of mindset. It is time for break. When we come back, where does that mindset of eugenics lead? Straight to the socialist's least favorite socialist, of course. Stay with us. And welcome back. We'll continue our discussion with Jonathan E. Ward, author of the book, The Authoritarians. And Jonathan, in terms of eugenics, one of the things that I just, you know, and it really it's evil cousin, euthanasia. You just see how this socialist Marxist thought led straight to the Nazis. And in reading your book, the Nazis, despite what the left says now and their attempt to distance themselves from the whole Nazi movement, I mean, they were really the culmination of socialist thinking, the highest and best example of what a socialist state could and, in fact, does look like. And this I found just really amazing from your book there. It says, indeed, during the Nuremberg trials, Nazi defendants repeatedly cited Buck versus Bell in defense of their extermination of the Jews and others deemed unfit. So here the Nazis are using American legal precedent to say, hey, we're just doing what you guys thought was the right thing to do. That's astounding.
And true. We were first in eugenics by comparison with the Germans, and the Germans adopted much of the science, quote unquote, and the legal philosophy of eugenics, which then, of course, underlaid the final solution. It became state dogma, and all of this, of course, arises from collectivism, from the idea that we ought not evaluate and consider people based on their individual merits, but ought to instead view them as part of a group. And you're either in a group that is favored politically, or you're in a group that is disfavored politically. And as you see, when you create this mix of politics and science, you can then justify the extermination of the politically undesirable. And that, of course, is what Germany did. They proceeded with the philosophy of Buck versus Bell to its logical extreme, and they cited to it in the Nuremberg trials as a basis for what they did. They said, look, we're not doing anything other than what you yourself advocated lawful in the United States. And indeed, at the time of the Nuremberg trials, remember, that's in the 1940s, we still were sterilizing people in this country under the legal authority of Buck versus Bell.
Well, I just found that whole discussion so fascinating because, you know, he's often held up as one of the greatest jurists ever, Oliver Wendell Holmes, and yet in your discussion of him, it was astounding to witness the convoluted ways around the Constitution or even ways to subvert it. Whether you're talking health issues or compelling forced vaccinations or sterilization or that you can't use your First Amendment rights to criticize the government, even if the allegations are true. A lot of that was just really amazing to read that. So where are we now in this spectrum where on one end we have the Constitution being supreme to protect rights versus the other end, common good can overrule rights? Have many of the Holmes's common good rulings, have they been since overruled and the Constitution protections for individual rights restored, or where are we on that spectrum now?
We're very much on the side of this notion that the common good is definable by the state and that individual liberties that run against the common good are to be eliminated. And that is the foundation of the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party is really indistinguishable from Hegelians in the sense that they don't believe that individual rights should ever stand in the way of achievement of something they deem the common good. The mandatory vaccination idea, for example, is just another iteration of this philosophy that regardless of the individual merits of your case, whether you have natural immunity, whether you work in isolation away from others, whether you drive a truck and are not in the presence of others, whether you have religious scruples against vaccination, whether you have a pre-existing condition that makes vaccination disadvantageous or even life-threatening. They run roughshod over all of that with sort of this supreme Fauciism that everyone, regardless of your circumstance, every American must be vaccinated, this mass collective movement to achieve 100% vaccination and to suffer the consequences to achieve this common good. Individuals who appropriately argue against it and who nonetheless have a right to argue against it are subsumed, even their own bodies taken under the control of the state to achieve this common good. And it reminds me very much of George Washington's admonition at the very start of this nation that let there be no change by usurpation, for though in one instance it may be an instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. Our founding generation understood all too well from the experience of tyranny from Great Britain that this idea of a collective good, which was visited upon them again and again by the crown and by its ministers, that they needed to accept taxation, that they needed to accept, even though they had no representation, that they needed to accept impressment, that they needed to accept judges from England and not be judged by judges from their own jurisdictions, that they needed to have their assemblies disband in order to serve, all to serve the common good or the greater good of the empire, as opposed to protect the and run and permitted them to roughshod over individual liberties. Ours was a rights revolution, and these principles that they use today to justify deprivation of individual rights and to call for, like in critical race theory, to demand uniform acceptance and no dissent from this dogma of Marxism that that children ought to hate themselves because they're either oppressed or oppressors, that they ought to hate each other because they are of this difference,
and
that they ought to hate their country and that they ought to hate free enterprise. This builds a society that hates itself and destroys itself rather than one that will defend us against tyranny from abroad. We have the enemies of tyranny that we have fought in foreign wars who would have brought this this slavery to us are now amongst us and are bringing slavery through the state, and we don't seem to even realize it.
Yeah,
we seem to be irritated by it, but not willing to stand up for our rights against it. We need to change that.
Yes, absolutely. And if you do stand up, suddenly you're the terrorist. It's just astounding how we've shifted this. Okay, we will continue our discussion with Jonathan Emord about his latest book, The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. Coming up, taking on the Hegelian Marxist thinking, let the pushback begin. And welcome back. We're continuing our discussion with Jonathan Emord from last week. This is part two. Part one, if you miss it, is available on iSpyRadio.com. Just look over in the right-hand column for last week's show. Or you can get it on your favorite podcasting platform. And while you're there, please hit the subscribe button. It's completely free. By subscribe, all it means is that you get a notification when there's a new show available. And those are usually posted on Mondays after it airs here on our network of radio stations around Oregon. And when you subscribe in the weird techno kind of way, it helps others find us too. So we really appreciate that. Jonathan Emord is one of America's top constitutional lawyers, and we've been talking about the mindset of America's greatest enemies, which you can learn more about by reading his book, The Authoritarians. So as far as taking on this Hegelian and Marxist thinking, why is it that they think that people cannot, or at least should not, decide for themselves? I mean, and why have to spread that here? There are some countries that believe this way. If you're so dissatisfied with all of this freedom, why don't they go there and make these places like Venezuela, you know, the utopia that they claim that it could be?
Well, it starts from really a contempt of others, a hatred for individual freedom. If you look at the world and you see excesses and abuses, and you say that that springs from individual liberty rather than from licentiousness, that is rare, rather than it being rare, you view it as commonplace, then you're more apt to find this idea of having an elite group that controls others justifiable. When you think that the world is made up of corrupt individuals who abuse others, and that that's the common, you end up with this idea that the policing of that population needs to be more intense, more exacting, and more complete. And that is where these Marxists and anarchists and socialists come from. They come from this really abysmal place where they hate themselves, they hate everything, and they want to bring it all down. They want to tear it down and destroy it. And what they don't appreciate until it's too late for them and for everyone else is that when you ultimately have a power that is fulsome enough to deprive everyone of their liberty, you end up with total misery, because our essence as people is to be free, to exercise free agency, mm-hmm. to have freedom of choice. When we are denied that, we're miserable. Every nation on earth that has experienced it, the people are miserable. And it also deprives you of the very genius of innovation.
Yes.
You become a threat if you're different. You must conform. Conformity destroys innovation. Conformity destroys the achievements that are necessary to advance society. The great irony is that communists say that their system is necessary to advance society in the right way. The problem with communism is that in practice, it doesn't advance mm-hmm. society. It retards society. It brings down everything that is above, creates a universal mediocrity, and utterly destroys the incentive to get out of it. It's a cesspool from which you cannot escape.
Yes.
And that is the hard lesson that people learn when they actually do the horrible thing of destroying people's rights and liberties and substituting for the will of the state.
Oh, absolutely. I did find it interesting, as far as pushing back against Marxism and that thinking, I found it interesting that so many of these progressives can do an about-face when they're criticized. In your book, Holmes had ruled for censorship in the Schenck case, faced criticism, and then 8 months later, ruled essentially the opposite way. I suppose that stems from being more concerned about what man thinks than what God thinks. Is that really one of the ways forward, is unleash heaps of criticism on them?
Well, it is. In Holmes's case, he believed in majoritarian rule. He didn't believe in protection for minority rights. So confronted with a mass opposition from academia, from his peers, to what he had done, he just shifted. He didn't have any, in other words, he didn't have an anchor in any philosophy. He did what he thought the majority wanted him to do. That, in fact, he wanted something of that sort to be his epitaph on his gravestone, that essentially might makes right. Majoritarian rule is the way to go. Follow it and you will achieve more than if you protect minority rights. Let the minority be trampled. And that's what he believed. So I think in convert, you know, getting the Marxist to change is a very hard thing to do. Fortunately for us, the overwhelming majority of us are not Marxists. No. But we are a silent majority.
Yeah, and I certainly
and in order to overcome this, we have to become vocal.
Yeah, I certainly think that what we're going through right now is definitely waking people up to where this could all head.
Yes,
okay,
I agree.
Okay, we will wrap things up with Jonathan Emord after this, including some practical steps to take and the one simple law that could fix almost all of this. And welcome back into our final segment now with Jonathan Emord, author of the terrific and very timely book, The Authoritarians. You really need to get this book. It will help you better understand what we are truly fighting here in America, how we got here, and the mindset behind it, and some practical steps on how to fight it. Jonathan, when we opened the show, we said that we wanted to give our audience some of your suggestions for how we stop this before it's too late. But let's start with that idea of before it's too late, because that's really the thing. How dangerously close are we to losing our country if people don't stand up and reassert their rights?
We are very close to losing our country, and it is a precipitous fall. I think people have realized from how rapidly things have changed under the Biden administration within only 7 or 8 months, that if this continues at the pace it is, that we will really be in a country that is indistinguishable from a Venezuela. Where the economy is ravaged, inflation is running rampant beyond our ability to pay for basic things necessary for life and to sustain it, and where we have people divided based on race and people divided based on their status of vaccinated or not. This movement of pitting Americans against one another, of not calling us all Americans entitled to the great promise of the Declaration of Independence, but telling us that America has failed, that America is not something to stand up for and fight for, that the economy is destructive of people, and that we ought to ruin everything, destroy everything, and replace it with this Green New Deal socialism, this idea that the state will define for us planned economies. We've all seen this before. This is what happened in the Soviet Union. This is the way in which we can totally ruin the great promise of both individuals and of our whole nation. So I think people are awakening to this. We have a majority, an overwhelming majority that disagrees. We have an overwhelming majority that is patriotic, that loves this country, that believes in free enterprise, that stands for the principles in the Declaration of Independence, that believes in the Constitution, that wants the rule of law, that doesn't support lawlessness, that doesn't believe violence is ever appropriate in order to change things socially, and who are willing to stand for that to an extent. But they first have to realize their numbers. We have to realize that we are the majority. We have to become vocal. Individuals have to become political. They hate it, but they have to. They have to become politically active in their school boards. They have to become politically active in the electoral process. If the majority that supports freedom in this country went to vote, they would so overwhelm those who are against it that the composition of Congress and the White House would shift in favor of those who stand for this country, defend its interests, yes, at home and abroad, and don't cut and run like Biden did in Afghanistan.
Yes.
And leave behind Americans,
yeah,
and our allies. I mean, this is the philosophy of self-destruction that is predominant in the Biden administration is one that Americans loathe.
Yes.
We really are a people of greatness. And we have to realize that again and appreciate that we are in the majority. We shouldn't be crying, lamenting, and cowering. We ought to be triumphant and asserting our rights and demanding protection for them and going after the lawbreakers and prosecuting them and throwing them in prison and ensuring that the rule of law is triumphant. But that requires political change and that requires legal change. Yes. But we can do this.
Yes. And it requires a warlike mindset. We have to realize that we are, in fact, at war now. You give about 20 some suggestions. And just real quick here, I just want to touch on this one. You say we should advocate legislation that causes every regulation to be revoked unless passed into law by Congress. This was a bill that you'd written for Ron Paul. Why don't you talk to us about this real quick? Got about a minute.
Yes. So it was called the Congressional Responsibility and Accountability Act that I wrote for Ron Paul. And what it would do is make regulations unlawful unless they were passed by Congress. And the reason for that is to restore the constitutional balance, the separation of powers and the investiture of the vesting clauses of the power to create law in Congress so that Congress couldn't escape responsibility. Right now, Congress is in agreement with the vast majority of laws being created by the unelected administrative state because they can avoid accountability for the actions of the administrative state, simply pointing it to their constituents to, oh, that was an EPA regulation. Oh, that was an action by the FDA. Oh, I'll write a letter to the commissioner or the chairman of these agencies. That's a cop-out. They are responsible under the Constitution for all laws, and we should the lawmaking by the administrative state. In fact, we should end the administrative state in America.
Absolutely. What a novel concept, getting back to the idea of actually passing laws. Jonathan, I thank you so much for your time. This has been absolutely fascinating. We'd love to have you back on again soon.
You bet.
That law that Jonathan mentioned that he wrote for Ron Paul is truly brilliant. You really need to read the book to understand that more. All regulations are null and void unless Congress actually codifies it as a law. Brilliant and simple. It should be the rallying cry of all of those who want to restore America to a republic because it makes Congress responsible to do their job, pass laws, which makes them liable to their voters, and stop hiding behind agencies. Do your job and stop letting whoever is president be king. We will be having Jonathan on again probably next month because off mic he was telling us about how to hold officials accountable, like that DA in Multnomah County who decided not to enforce the law and let all of those Antifa burn and loot and destroy and hold none of them accountable. Well, it's time to hold him accountable, all of them, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.